Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Maria Casa, Director of the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio and transcript will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Elizabeth Prodromou and Nathaniel Simeonides with us today to discuss the social and political implications of the Holy and Great Council of the Orthodox Church, convened this month in Crete. Elizabeth Prodromou is Visiting Associate Professor of Conflict Resolution at Tufts University's Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy. She is also co-chair of the Eastern Mediterranean and Europe Study Group at Harvard University's Center for European Studies. Between 2004 and 2012, before coming to Fletcher, Dr. Prodromou served as Vice Chair and Commissioner for the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. She is a member of the U.S. Secretary of State's Religion and Foreign Policy Working Group and holds a PhD and Master's degree in Political Science from MIT. Nathaniel Simeonides is the Director of the Office of Inter-Orthodox, Ecumenical, and Interfaith Relations for the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America. He was ordained a deacon by His Eminence Archbishop Demetrios in 2003 and a presbyter by the Archbishop in 2010. And has served as the pastor of the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church in New York City. He is a graduate of Hellenic College and the Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology, and holds a Doctor of Theology in Bioethics from Boston University and a Master of Science degree from Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Welcome, Elizabeth and Father Nathaniel. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Maureen. It's great to be with you.
Father Nathaniel, could you start us off by providing our listeners with the historical and ecclesiastical context for the Holy and Great Council? Then maybe Elizabeth could provide some analysis of the geopolitical features of the Council.
Sure. For those who have studied anything about the Orthodox Church, they'll know that usually the Orthodox Church moves very, very slowly when it tries to organize itself or to meet as a one church, and it also does it in a way that often goes unnoticed. So for the majority of the world, this council has gone unnoticed, and it's taken the church quite some time to actually convene the council. Most realize that the Orthodox Church, for us, conciliarity or synodality is present at the core of the church. It's part of who we are and how we do things. And in the first millennium, we know that there are several councils, some lesser, some greater, and some ecumenical councils. We have seven ecumenical councils. And usually when people study the Eastern Orthodox Church or Byzantium or Orthodoxy, they kind of focus most of their attention on the first millennium, especially when they study councils of the church. After the great schism between the church in the East and the church in the West, councils still exist. They are still important in the life of the Orthodox Church or the four patriarchates in the East. However, it was impossible to convene a greater council or a global council in the same way as the church was able to do so in the first millennium. For obvious reasons, the Church of Rome was no longer in communion with the church in the East, so in many ways that was one reason. However, another reason it was not able to convene a greater council was for geopolitical circumstances, especially in the last 200 years or so. However, in the early 20th century, by 1902, we have a movement by the Ecumenical Patriarchate to try to create greater cooperation and coordination among the Orthodox churches in the East. Greater councils were convened by the Ecumenical Patriarchate, to handle issues related to the broader life of the church in the East, and it would include representatives from various churches. However, these churches were still unable to come together as often as they would like. So by 1902, Patriarch Joachim III sends an encyclical to all the churches, encouraging them to start thinking about ways to get together. In the 1920s, by 1923, we have a Pan-Orthodox conference in Constantinople convened by Patriarch Metaxakis. And Patriarch Metaxakis is considered a very progressive, forward-thinking ecumenical patriarch, and he begins to discuss with the other primates and other representatives of these churches issues, for instance, such as the calendar, common calendar for Easter, marriage of clergy after ordination, or the second marriage for widowed clergy. In 1930, there is another meeting convened on Mount Athos by the Ecumenical Patriarch Photius II. And it's at this meeting where the churches actually agree that they should move forward with the Holy and Great Council. They begin to start thinking about what could be on the agenda. Unfortunately, because of World War II and the rise of the Soviet Union, the work toward the Holy and Great Council kind of pauses until the 60s. It is by 1961 where we finally have pan-Orthodox conferences start to convene, the first one in 61, the second in 1963, and the third in 1964. And by 1964, we have an agenda that includes over 100 items for the Holy and Great Council, and it is at this third meeting in 1964 where the churches agree that there needs to be a preconciliar pan-Orthodox conference, that they finally need to start the preconciliar meetings. The first meeting of the Preconciliar Pan-Orthodox Conference takes place in 1976 in Chambézy. It is at this point where the representatives of the churches, the Eastern Orthodox churches, condense the agenda to 10 items. And it is they primarily do so because they want to be able to convene the council as quickly as possible. They realized that there was too much time that had gone by from, you know, 1902, 1923, that they put several of the items on hold, selected 10 of them, because they felt that those were issues that could be more easily addressed at the council. The second and the third meetings of this preconciliar conference take place in 1982 and 1986. After the 1986 meeting, there is another pause in the preconciliar work, and the work toward the council starts up again in 2008. So if we can imagine over 20 years have gone by, the agenda is still the same. We now have, unfortunately, new representatives, new primates, of these churches looking at the same old agenda. So in 2008, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew holds a synaxis, or a gathering of the primates of the churches, and tries to give it a boost, give the meetings for the Holy and Great Council a boost, trying to get the primates themselves to agree on some issues rather than only focus on slower preconciliar conference meetings. In 2009, we have the fourth preconciliar conference. So again, the third was 1986. By 2009, we have the fourth. And it's at this meeting where the churches agree on the formation of episcopal assemblies in the so-called diaspora regions around the world. In 2014, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew again convenes a meeting of the primates in Constantinople. And it is at this meeting that the primates agreed that they were finally ready to convene the council in 2016 on the Feast of Pentecost. The council was to be convened in the Church of the Peace of God, or Hagia Irini, in Istanbul. Unfortunately, this past year, the conflict or the rising tension between Turkey and Russia made it impossible for some of the churches, including the Church of Russia, to actually travel to Istanbul. And so the primates agreed that the venue would move to Crete. This past January 2016, the primates met for one final time. They looked at the agenda, the approved text, and we finally reached the point where from 10 agenda items, we were down to 6 items that generated consensus among the primates for the Holy and Great Council. In terms of the internal workings of the council, how it was convened, how it operated, and so forth, in the first millennium, these ecumenical councils were convened by the emperor. And so for the Orthodox Church, now without an emperor who would convene and encourage the bishops to attend the council, the primates agreed that the ecumenical patriarch is the one who convened the council, that the other primates agreed to go to the council, and that the ecumenical patriarch also presides over the council. We have 14 local autocephalous churches in the Orthodox world, 14 recognized globally autocephalous Orthodox churches, and they all agreed to go. And they were all part of the process leading up to the Holy and Great Council. They also agreed that decisions would be taken by a process of consensus, which was at times interpreted as unanimity. So that was something very new for the Orthodox Church, how they actually would sit down and vote on these issues together. And also they agreed that instead of inviting all bishops from all over the world, which was impossible for practical reasons but also pastoral reasons, they would only have 24 bishops, up to 24 bishops from each church and their primate. There were to be 6 consultants for each church, which could include bishops, other clergy, as well as the laity. And they also agreed to have observers from various Christian churches and ecumenical organizations. By a few weeks before the convening of the council, we started to see a few churches stating that they were not able to attend or would not attend for their own reasons. We started off with Bulgaria, the Church of Bulgaria, who said it could not come, which was followed by Antioch, the Church of Antioch, then by the Church of Georgia, and finally by the Church of Russia. The council was still convened. The ecumenical patriarch and the other primates, the other 9 churches, felt that they could still convene the council since in theory and in essence, the church, the Orthodox Church, agreed to convene it. There was nothing that these 4 churches, there wasn't any issue that kept them from being able to convene the council. They were, just one other thing, and I'm assuming that Elizabeth will bring this up. During the council, there was dialogue not only among the hierarchs in the room, but also the council with others outside of the room. So the council communicated, for example, with Patriarch Ignatius Ephrem of the Syriac Orthodox Church after the attempt on his life. It also communicated with Patriarch Kirill after 15 kids were tragically lost their lives in a summer camp. And they also, the council also sent a letter to the 4 churches that did not attend, asking them to reconsider, and if they could not attend the council, to at least come and attend the Divine Liturgy. The council, lastly, and I'll close with this, issued an encyclical, which is a 20-plus page document. It issued a message, which was read during the Divine Liturgy, which is a 5-page document summarizing the encyclical. And the council also edited, reviewed, and accepted all 6 of the agenda items and decisions taken. I would just say that this was, by and large, a very difficult exercise in conciliarity. And as some of the observers said to us when meeting with them, that this was not only difficult for the Orthodox Church, but this was also very difficult and very important for the rest of the Christian world. They were also looking to see how conciliarity can look today on the highest level in the 21st century. And so they were very much excited and interested to see how the council would work and what it would produce. So with that, I'll turn it over to Elizabeth.
That gives us great context. Elizabeth, would you like to speak to some of the geopolitical aspects of the council?
Sure. I thought it might be useful to begin by giving some insight into my particular vantage point. As Father Nathaniel mentioned, each delegation from each of the autocephalous churches had six official advisors that were part of the delegation, and I was one of the six on the delegation of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. So I was one of, I believe, three women who were actually in the council and part of the council for the entire proceedings. So my comments come from that particular vantage point and refracted through that lens along with the others, as a social scientist and a policy person. So I wanted to kind of give that context. I think that from my perspective, what's very interesting, why people should care, because I guess one of the questions associated with the council is, why should people care? What's interesting about the Great and Holy Council of the Orthodox Church? Two reasons. Number one is I think that we see a story of religion as a transnational actor in the 21st century. That's a big part of, I think, what comes out of this council. And the other reason is that we see religion as part of the broader geopolitical set of developments in the 21st century. And I want to say a little bit about each of those very briefly to Father Nathaniel's given us a pretty rich background. I would like to make a distinction between what I think has been the narrative that's been pretty dominant in the international media, which is that of Orthodox geopolitics on the one hand, and then what we might call orthodoxy and geopolitics. And I think these are two distinct but related things. So in terms of the first, Orthodox geopolitics, or the ecclesiastical politics amongst these 14 autocephalous churches and then the 10 who came as opposed to the 4 who did not come. The standard narrative I think that we've read, and I would say that it's a narrative that's been largely constructed by the Moscow Patriarchate and the government of Vladimir Putin, and that's been given an echo chamber, unfortunately from my perspective, in the international press, went something like the following. Led by the Russian Church and the Patriarchate of Moscow, the churches of Georgia, Bulgaria, and Antioch pulled out of the Holy and Great Council at the last minute on account of a very specific set of concerns. Number one, the Ecumenical Patriarch's of Constantinople's pretensions to use the council to establish his authority, modeled on a kind of papal primacy rather than on the primacy of honor enjoyed by the Ecumenical Patriarchate. Number two, the Ecumenical Patriarch's management of the six agenda items for the council, as well as reports on the eve of the council that consensus is the operating principle of the council in the form of unanimity as opposed to majority voting would be overturned. In other words, unanimity would be overturned for majority voting. And that at the end of the day, this is also the four no-shows were part of the larger story of tension in the axis between Constantinople and Moscow for primacy in the Orthodox world. So that's the sort of synthesis of the quite conventional narrative that's now out there, I think, in the media. And that's what I would call the, you know, Orthodox geopolitics narrative. It's all about inter-church, competition, at best, intrigue, at worst. And a footnote to that, claims that there's a Greek, Slav, Arab, ethno-national cleavage at work within the old world mother churches. My view is that in order to really understand and parse that narrative, one needs to look at orthodoxy and geopolitics, but I want to say just a brief word about the orthodox geopolitics piece. And again, Father Nathaniel touched on some of these things. The first one, that the ecumenical patriarch was trying to establish a kind of papal primacy here amongst all the orthodox churches, a primacy of power rather than honor. Again, this council has been over a century in the making. If we look back at the historical experience of the unified church, as well the pre-11th century church, as well as the way in which the Orthodox Church has operated since then, there's absolutely no question about the primacy of honor that's enjoyed by the ecumenical patriarchate. So again, this notion that this was a kind of power play on the part of Constantinople doesn't stand up in the face of the historical and contemporary evidence and functioning of the church. The second issue about how to define conciliarity or conciliar consensus, there was a quite robust discussion, in fact, in all of the preparatory councils about this very issue. And I think in the interest of bringing these churches together in a global council, there was not a definitive definition of consensus. It was either unanimity or majority vote, and that's something that came up quite robustly in the discussions. And then finally, in terms of this notion of a kind of, ethno-national cleavage between Greek, Slav, and Arab churches, without a doubt, the history of the historical wellspring of these churches is Byzantine Hellenism. Expanding the church from the Hellenic world into the Arab and Slavic cultural pales, with a very complex history of relations among these three cultural spaces. But what's also very clear is that there was a recognition, and in fact it was given explicit voice in the council itself, about the what were called the evils of ethno-nationalism or ethnophilitism, in other words, a condemnation of nationalism and national and ethnic identities as prior to religious identities. So the council came down very hard on the side of religious identity as the unifying feature amongst these churches. So if that's the kind of orthodox geopolitics narrative, the orthodoxy and geopolitics narrative is, I would say, is as follows. I mean, first of all, as I said earlier, this is a narrative I think that's been laid out by the Moscow Patriarchate and more specifically by the Putin government. We tend to mistake the Moscow Church or the Russian Church as a strong church given its numbers and also its material resources, but the fact of the matter is it's a church living in an authoritarian, polity, and so the degrees of maneuverability for this church, I think we need to take, with some degree of skepticism. That's the first point. The second point is, again, I think understanding the way in which that church has been able to exercise leverage over the other three who didn't come are also very much related to Russia's own geopolitical objectives in Europe and Eurasia, in particular in what Russia considers its near abroad of Ukraine and the Black Sea and the Caucasus, and also in terms of Southeastern Europe. So I'll be happy to drill down more deeply into those kinds of geopolitical objectives, but without a doubt, the Russian state, I think, has been a critical behind-the-scenes player, in terms of its geopolitical objectives in this intra-Orthodox story. And then finally, just a quick footnote in terms of other takeaways. I think from the council, what's very clear is that this was the Orthodox Church, growing and maturing into its identity as a global church with faithful on all of the continents around the world. And also this was a very interesting exercise in discussing the links between religion and democracy, and that gets at the question of consensus as unanimity versus majority. And there was actually a quite lively discussion about how to think about voice in the church. And in this case, as in many other cases, the churches of Cyprus and Albania really took the lead in what I would argue is a quite progressive and open-ended understanding of the compatibility between orthodoxy and democracy, and ultimately about the Orthodox Church coming to terms with pluralism within as well as living in a religiously plural world. So I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you both for an excellent overview. Let's open up to the group for questions now.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 now. Our first question will come from Paul DeVries with New York Divinity School.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Elizabeth and Nathaniel. It's very interesting to see this international fellowship and encouragement. In the meetings and deliberations, how did like social gospel or social application of the gospel enter in for different countries or even international relationships? Were there core examples or principles that come to mind from the meeting?
I can begin unless you want to start, Father. Just two quick points. The importance of the social gospel, I think, and the social application of the gospel was a continuous feature and an active feature of the conversations in the council. I mentioned earlier the Church of Albania and the Orthodox Church of Cyprus, but also the Church in Nigeria, the Church in Cameroon, the Patriarchate of Alexandria, and, of course, the Ecumenical Patriarch. All of these delegations emphasize the importance, ultimately, of the Church's foundational mission in this world, which is to evangelize and its social ministry. And there was a real sensibility and sensitivity to the fact that this mission takes precedence over all other considerations. So that was a quite active piece of the conversation, and it played itself out within various agenda items, and I found that also to be quite interesting in the discussion about fasting, in the discussion about diaspora, and then certainly in terms of the church's role in ecumenical and interfaith work, and then finally the church in the world. This was a continuous theme that linked all of the agenda items in this council.
Just add to that it was also present even in the discussion about marriage, and also the most of the churches, kind of the primates, were all. So the discussion about the social gospel also came through in the discussion across the room. Even though the churches, say in Serbia or Czech land or Poland may not have spoken about this through their primates, several of their bishops in diasporas mentioned the need to be present in the world, to serve the world, to bring Christ to the world. So for sure, the kind of the Patriarchate of Alexandria also at times paused the discussion, the theological discussion, and brought it down to the very kind of lives of people who are suffering.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Tom Reese with the National Catholic Reporter.
Thank you. Actually, I think this question is more, I have a couple of hats. Question more as a member of the Commission, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I'm wondering what the Council had to say about religious freedom. I think back to the Second Vatican Council, which had a whole document on religious liberty. And so I'm curious what the Council may have said about religious freedom. And connected to that, what it may have said about the relationship between church and state, separation of church and state, those kinds of issues. Thank you.
Elizabeth, if I can just say just a few words on that, and then I'm sure you'll add to it from your own vantage point. Religious freedom was brought up, and it's actually in the documents. It's in the message itself, and we were quite fortunate to have Elizabeth present in the room to help shape some of the language. And it's also what we consider religious freedom in church-state relations, let's say from a Western perspective, a U.S. perspective, is very different from the perspective of these churches. The separation of church and state for some of these churches doesn't make any sense. They can't see, and many of them are struggling with it now, because they don't necessarily have the same state as they once did that was supportive of the church. But for them to think of a separation of church and state doesn't make sense, and it actually is not very helpful in their mind for promoting the gospel. They're still quite unable to think of what that looks like. It certainly doesn't look like a U.S. model or from a Western European model. And again, Elizabeth, I'm sure you can kind of speak to this more in detail.
Sure. And by the way, congratulations, Tom, as the new chair, I believe, of the USERP. So I wish you well in your work. In terms of the issue of religious freedom and more generally questions of the church and the world in relation to the state, I would urge you to take a look at the final message. I believe I'm trying to discern whether it's the message or the encyclical or the message, but paragraph 10 in I think it's in the message deals specifically with the issue of religious freedom. And the church speaks about its insistence on the fundamental human right of religious freedom and the church's commitment to the protection of religious freedom, which, you know, they define very much, very consistently with international human rights law and as freedom of conscience, belief, religion, alone and in community, et cetera. But I'd counsel you to take a direct look at paragraph 10 in the message. There's also throughout the message as well, the concluding message as well as the encyclical, a reference to the church's rejection of involvement in politics. And I think although it wasn't expressed in these terms, you know, an engagement in the public sphere. This goes back to the previous question, you know, the practicing of the social gospel, but this being distinct from involvement in politics. There's a discussion about the church's prophetic mission and the responsibility of the church and its obligations to protect rights of citizens and also to be a social critic, but also to engage in self-criticism. There are also references throughout both the encyclical and the message to condemnation of violence in the name of religion and violence between and amongst religions. In terms of compatibility compatibility with the way in which international organizations think about freedom of religion, there was a clear statement on the part of those present that rings quite consistent with how we think about that. In terms of the church-state issue, there wasn't a discussion by any means, but I think Father Nathaniel's quite right that many of these churches, at least in the old world, I think, you know, have lived in contexts where clearly there hasn't been a full separation of religion and state, and I would say more specifically where non-democratic states have tried to either, you know, penetrate or co-opt, or if that wasn't possible, crush these churches, and so there's a real sensitivity to, you know, that history. But there's also a real awareness. I heard that expressed in the, you know, categorical condemnation of ethno-nationalism, or again what they call ethnophilitism, of the problems that come from too close a relationship with the state. And again, now putting on my hat as a political scientist, I would say that, you know, the general kind of
reduction of Orthodox churches as looking very different from, you know, other churches. And we use the term in the West, I guess I would say the rest of Europe. I think it's as in the rest of Europe, in European countries and in other parts of the world, that's a far more nuanced and, you know, diverse story than a kind of essentialized view has long provided.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, just as a reminder, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. Our next question will come from Lauren Homer with Homer International Law.
Hi. Thanks to both of you for that great presentation. My attention right now is on the Middle East, and particularly Syria and Iraq, where Orthodox Christians and others are suffering so much persecution from the Islamic State and other radical groups. And I'm wondering, first of all, whether the Council addressed that issue. Secondly, whether they talked or thought about the relationship between separation of church and state and how that adversely affects Christians living in religious states where the only allowed or the primary religion is Islam. And then third, whether you think the Council may have had some impact on Russian-Turkish political relationships, and I have in mind the fact that a few days ago, to my surprise, Turkey apologized to Russia for shooting down its plane and for the death of the pilot.
I guess, Father, do you want to begin?
Yeah, I can just say, for one, I would say that the situation in the Middle East, especially in Syria and Iraq, was on the mind of the members of the Council, I think primarily because the church that is present in those regions wasn't there. So although the Church of Antioch was not present to specifically bring this up, to mention it by name per se, the fact that the hierarchs consistently thought of Antioch and their absence brought those issues to the fore. The other thing is, I would just say the Orthodox Church in general and Christianity as a whole is a persecuted church. I mean, what is going on in the Middle East is just a snapshot of what the churches in the East have endured, not necessarily only at the hands of radical Islamic groups, but by radicals in general that have often used religion for their own purposes and often in violent ways. There was the Church of Jerusalem that is also present in the region, is present in Jordan and in Jerusalem, and they also brought this up, and also the attack on Patriarch Ignatius of Rome during a memorial service also reminded the hierarchs of the situation in the Middle East, that although they were in Crete, there were other brothers and sisters just, you know, further south, southeast from them that were being persecuted.
Yeah, as a kind of follow-up to Father Nathaniel's points, in terms of Syria and Iraq, as he rightly points out, the absence of the Patriarchate of Antioch meant that that church was not represented formally. But I think there was a profound awareness expressed and directly and indirectly about the precarious position of the Orthodox Church of Orthodox churches in the greater Middle East. And I would underscore the fact that, notwithstanding the absence of Antioch, the fact that Constantinople and Jerusalem were there, and by the way, I use that term ecclesiastically and not in any other way, the fact that Constantinople and Jerusalem and Alexandria were there really underscored the fact that these three churches themselves have experienced many of the things that the churches in Iraq and Syria are experiencing. And I think that's very important to kind of insert into the way we think about the history and the present and the future of the region as hopefully a region of religious pluralism that really recaptures and re-energizes the historical pluralism of that part of the world. The Church of Constantinople has, you know, endured 90 years in terms of the modern state of repression and in many cases persecution. And, you know, the Church in Jerusalem finds itself in a very complicated part of the world for all faith traditions. And then as far as Alexandria goes, the same holds true there. So there was real expression, and I think this is, for me, what was most heartening and most important in terms of what churches might contribute to stabilization on the ground. There was a real open expression of the commitment to interfaith dialogue and cooperation, and I think that there's a real awareness, and we heard it expressed there, of the absolute necessity for interfaith cooperation in order to bring any modicum of peace to that part of the world, and certainly in order to stave off the very real possibility of the complete erasure of, you know, the Orthodox and churches and Christianity from that part of the world. And there's also a real, you know, awareness that these churches don't want to become museum churches, that they are committed through the practice of the social gospel to being living, active churches there. And that, you know, that underscoring of the commitment to interfaith dialogue and ecumenical cooperation as part of, you know, what's necessary for the church itself to survive, I think was a quite active piece of the conversation.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Drew Christensen with Georgetown University.
Thank you. I'm wondering whether you can touch on the highlights of the message for us, to see what points the members of the Synod wanted to make known to the world.
Father, do you want to begin?
Yeah, I'm actually getting it up on my screen so I can just refresh my memory because I have my notes, but I want to give me 1 second.
I think we've actually touched on a lot of those in terms of the key points. You know, the respect for international human rights, for religious freedom, a commitment to interfaith dialogue and pluralism. Ultimately, the key priority of proclaiming the unity of the church and the unity of the Orthodox Church as a global church that ultimately functions in according to these principles of conciliarity. And I think conciliarity is something that's quite interesting in general for you know, those interested in religion and international affairs and for ecumenical and interfaith dialogue. This conciliarity being quite messy, an organizational principle, it doesn't operate according to a strictly top-down model, but there is a kind of hierarchical logic to it, but one that is premised on the notion of, you know, engagement, debate, discussion, and ultimately, I guess what we would call in other contexts, consensus and compromise. And I think that was a message that that the church also wanted to convey, and also to convey the church's commitment to proclaiming the social and participating in the social gospel.
Yeah, I would just say specifically if the longer the message, the encyclical, section number one basically has to do with the nature of the church. What is church? And I think if you look at that closely, you'll see that the Orthodox Church is trying to share with the world its own understanding of who it is, what are we. There was a great discussion during the council for 2 days, I think, on what is church, what is the Orthodox Church, how does the Orthodox Church relate to other churches, other Christians. So if you look at section one, you'll see how that comes through and that the Orthodox Church is struggling to put into kind of the language of the day to help others understand who we are, just rather than thinking that we're the ancient church or a church with ancient practices, or as Elizabeth said, a church that belongs in a museum. How do we express who we are today? And then that the other section that I would say is quite important is section five, which attempts to engage contemporary challenges and address those challenges. And you'll see in there that's probably one of the sections that is most weak, but it is a section that shows that the Orthodox Church is eager and willing and able to try to address some of the challenges facing the world today. So we'll just look at section one and section five.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lois Varg with Luther Seminary.
Thank you so much for your very excellent introduction to understanding what happened in the Ecumenical Council. So based on what you said, 4 out of 14 churches did not attend. That is almost 1/3 of the Orthodox churches did not attend the council. So my question is, will the conciliar decisions be binding to the absent churches? Especially that, for example, the Russian Church is the largest and most prominent of them all, and having the Antiochian Church that is going through such a critical point in its history were not present. Are they obligated to take care of the and follow the obligations of the Council? My second part is, did the Council discuss the status of women in the Church?
Father, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. Well, in terms of the binding nature or if these decisions are binding, I would just say first, it is quite a missed opportunity for these four churches because the presence of the other 10 actually improves the decisions. So before they reached convened the council, the decisions were preliminarily approved by the primates and through the preconciliar process. So the decisions were not new. These churches agreed in principle to what was written, and the council provided the churches the opportunity to suggest amendments, revisions, and incorporate them to help improve these decisions. In essence, the text are the same in principle from start to end of the council, but there were several changes that helped improve the decisions. In most cases, it helped clarify some of the positions of the Orthodox Church. It took into consideration specific nuances in language, in different languages. So in essence, there really isn't any reason for these four churches who were not present to be able to accept the decisions of the council. Having said that, the decisions are now decisions of the church. The church had a council. There were some who were not there, and it's not the first time we have churches not present at a council. And it's up to the rest of the church, those who are not in the room, to start to receive these decisions. Not only members of the four churches who were not present, but all the churches. The Orthodox Church now has to receive these decisions and start to apply these decisions in everyday parish life. So there is the long process of reception. Whether these are binding, I don't know if that's the right word that we ought to be using. These are not legal documents. They're not contracts that people signed. These are expressions of the faith and decisions that help us live the faith today. So, again, in essence, I don't see any reason why the four churches could not and would not adopt them, since they already approved the preconciliar documents prior to the revisions and amendments. In terms of women in the church, I guess, Elizabeth, do you want to kind of take that on, take that on a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for, you know, throwing the ping pong ball over to me on that. let me just say one footnote on the issue of binding. One of the things that I took notice of as the council began and also as it concluded is was I think the softening tone of those who were missing and the soft response of those who were there. Interestingly enough, the 10 who were present communicated before the actual start of the council on the morning of the liturgy at Pentecost and, you know, requested, invited the other four who were there to please come. There were some responses, and so I guess I take that as a positive sign, glass half full sign, that you know, the lines of communication remained open. Also interesting in terms of whether or not you know, the decisions will be adopted and fully embraced, I think, is the question of the way in which each of these churches, and I think this reflects the church as a global whole, has its own internal tensions, conversations between those who would fall, I guess, on the more traditionalist side of the spectrum. And I won't say traditional, but I say traditionalist, you know, in a kind of almost religious ideology sense of the word, and those who are more, I would say, open and progressive. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, whether or not these decisions are fully embraced will also in some ways be a function of how those kinds of conversations, struggles, competitions play themselves out. And in that, the Orthodox Church, I mean, the Council shows the Orthodox Church looks pretty much like every other faith tradition around the world right now in terms of, you know, the internal, divisions and conversations about what it means to practice authentically, you know, one's faith. Regarding women in the church, no, there was no discussion there of women in the church. As I said, there were three women who were part of the official delegations in total. On the one hand, it was an honor. On the other hand, it was, I felt, a quite awesome responsibility to be in the room with all the men in black. My fervent hope is that there will be a far greater presence of women in councils moving forward, and not only in holy and great councils, but also as the conciliar process is, again, re-energized at the local level of churches. And I'm hopeful about that. The other thing that I think is very important here is that, you know, the Ecumenical Patriarch himself, as well as Archbishop Anastasios of Albania, went out there and did appoint women. And, you know, again, I wasn't in the room in the meetings leading up to the council, but I would, if I were a wagering person, I would say that that was a pretty visionary and for some radical thing to do. I would also call your attention to the fact that there was a petition that's available online that was signed by, as of yesterday when I looked at the count, I think 1,245 women from Orthodox churches around the world, entreating the Ecumenical Patriarch and the churches, the Orthodox churches, to include women more fully in the council. And interestingly enough, and I believe it's also online, there was a formal response from the Ecumenical Patriarch to the petitioners, saying that we hear you, we're listening, and we're moving. And so I think, again, the fact that that conversation is happening, it is indeed a conversation, and to me that is, that's very encouraging. I guess the real question is, you know, whether or not the time clock moves according to your, you know, Timex or iPhone watch piece, or whether it moves according to an eschatological timeline, and I'm pushing for the former rather than the latter.
Thank you. We have time for one more question.
Thank you. Our last question will come from John Burgess with the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary.
Hi, thanks very much. Very interesting conversation. I just wanted to add that I think with the Moscow Patriarchate, it's not just the influence of Vladimir Putin. It's it's also that this is a very conservative church, and there would not be a great groundswell of support from the grassroots for participation in the council. But having said that, I do wonder if anything came up at the council that would help us understand how the Orthodox churches will adjudicate jurisdictional disputes. In fact, I understand that that was one of the factors that kept Antioch from attending because of the situation in Qatar. And, of course, Moscow is looking at what's going to happen in Ukraine, where nearly half of its parishes are located. And yet the Ecumenical Patriarch is perceived as pushing for an autocephalous church that in Ukraine that would appear to undermine the interests of the Moscow Patriarchate. But more generally, was there anything to indicate how Orthodox churches will look in the future towards resolving these jurisdictional questions?
Yeah, I can start by saying that these jurisdictional questions are not new. Issues of jurisdiction, borders, and boundaries, and violation of those ecclesiastical borders have existed early on. It's actually one of the reasons why the Church of Cyprus was granted autocephalous status early in the history of the Church by the Second Ecumenical Council. So it's not something new. The Orthodox Church hopes that these, and oftentimes they are, these disputes are addressed and resolved bilaterally between the two churches in question. If they cannot, then there are other means to help find a solution, including appealing to the Ecumenical Patriarchate as kind of the church that helps promote and secure Orthodox unity. Several churches have done this in the past, in the first millennium and also in the second millennium, but it's only done when these churches have asked for assistance in trying to figure out how to resolve the problems. The issue of Qatar is quite unfortunate. The Ecumenical Patriarchate has offered to convene a committee to explore ways to resolve the problem that would include both the Church of Antioch and the Church of Jerusalem and overseen by the Ecumenical Patriarchate. But in essence, the Church has its canon, it has its history, and in many instances, it's a matter of discovering the history, the historical context, and identifying those canons that can help resolve these issues. I would just also say in terms of the Ukraine issue, I think you mentioned that the Ecumenical Patriarchate is seeking to establish an autocephalous church. I mean, I would just say that is not quite accurate. That's all.
To follow up on that. Just beginning with your first point about the Moscow Patriarchate, it's not just a story about the Putin government. That's certainly true. The church, if these labels mean anything, yes, is a quite conservative church. But I would go back to my earlier point, which is that we need to deconstruct all of these churches as we do with other religious institutions and other faith traditions and recognize that, within the Moscow Church itself and within the Russian Church itself, there's a pretty rigorous, competition and, set of disagreements about how to be church and also about the nature of the relationship of the church to the state. So just as I think this council was very useful in helping to kind of demystify the Orthodox Church, which for many people I think is, understood really by looking forward rather than looking backward rather than looking forward, I think deconstructing the church in Russia is a useful way to go. In terms of these jurisdictional disputes, thinking in terms of conflict resolution and negotiation, yes, the Jerusalem-Antioch disagreement over Qatar and also the question of autocephaly of Ukraine, at the end of the day, one of the prerogatives of the ecumenicity, in fact, in the Orthodox Church and therefore the See of Constantinople is its prerogative of dispute resolution, and both of these questions are ones that have are either actively or being taken up by the Patriarchate at Constantinople. On Ukraine, it is worth emphasizing, as Father Nathaniel did, that the move towards or the request for autocephaly has come not from pressures from the Ecumenical Patriarchate at Constantinople, but from requests from the Church in Ukraine. And I think that's a very important point to underscore, because, again, it gets to this notion of the logic of change within the Orthodox Church is one that is not, imposed from or driven from the top down. And as a consequence, I think, there's a degree of messiness that we see when it comes to negotiation and dispute resolution, but nonetheless, I think, offers possibilities for lots of different formulas. So I would leave it at that.
I'm sorry that time does not allow us to get to all the questions. Elizabeth and Father Nathaniel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today from Greece.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you.
My pleasure, and thank you for everyone on the call. I appreciated the questions and the kind of poking and prodding to think about these things from a variety of vantage points.
Yes, thank you to all the participants for questions and comments. We encourage you to follow CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements on upcoming events and information about the latest CFR resources. We look forward to your participation in future discussions.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.